Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to the Abroad in Japan podcast, probably the best way of learning about life in Japan without actually being in Japan. I'm your host, Chris Broad, and this week we're joined by not Pete Donaldson. He is away again. I'm let him having a rare holiday. And thank you to Pete for covering last week again while I was on journey across Japan, across Kyushu. But while I'm in Kyushu, I thought I would stop by and visit a good friend and do a little interview today. I'll say a little. Hopefully it'll be half an hour long. But I'm joined by the one and only Dogen.
Hey, everyone. Really happy to be here.
To see you, Dogen. For those of you who don't know, Dogen is kind of respected by, I think, nearly every YouTuber I know in Japan has a deep, profound respect for you, Dogen. Why is that?
I guess because I'm Nihongo Jōzu.
He's Nihongo Jōzu. He's very, very good at Japanese. His entire channel is kind of built around satirical skits and comedy sketches. He's very good at it, and his channel can be found, just type in Dogen, D-O-G-E-N.
Yep.
He's quite prominent on Twitter. Are you on TikTok?
No, I tried to set up a TikTok, but it wasn't for me, so I got...
Good man, yeah. Good man. Don't betray YouTube, Dogen. don't turn to the dark side.
Yeah, I took it off my phone.
But we'll be talking to Dogen about his experiences in Japan, what brought him here, what he's been doing. How long have you been here now? 10 years?
Yeah, a little bit over 10 years.
And you came, like I did, to Japan on the JET program, the Japan Exchange Teacher
Program. Yes, that's correct.
And became a teacher before moving on to the world of YouTube. But let's rewind, though. When did we first meet now, Dogen? It must have been years ago.
Yeah, I guess it was close to 5 years ago, because we met originally. You graciously kind of invited me to the YouTuber retreat.
That sounds a lot better than it was. It was the YouTuber retreat.
Yeah, so it was like
swanky... like Davos summit event. Yeah. It's just like 10 YouTubers in a shed.
Yeah. And yeah, well, I guess the other people, I mean, PDR was there. Mm. Duncan, he's maybe a lot more popular on the Japanese side of things.
Yeah. Joey was there.
Yeah, Joey was there.
I've met him for the first time there as well, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So we met then. And back then, I think you had 2,000 subscribers. Now, how many subscribers have you got?
I think close to 250,000.
Fantastic. And you're most prominent on Twitter, I think, where a lot of your sketches are.
Yeah. I don't have as many followers on Twitter, but I think my content is maybe better suited for Twitter than YouTube.
I mean, seeing as you're the pro on learning Japanese, that is a topic I really want to discuss today in this episode. Because I know many of you guys listening are learning Japanese at various stages. And many of you are looking to live and work in Japan at some point. So these are all topics that I'd like to cover. So first things first, what led you to Japan? The big question, the inevitable. Why are you here?
The big question. I kind of made a video about this not too long ago, actually. Mm. But I had like many different reasons that kind of changed over time. Like first it was martial arts. Then it was kind of like anime. Then it was Japanese video games. Then it was like Japanese women. And then it was, you know, Japanese cinema. And, you know, it was kind of just a combination of all these things. I think the fact that Japan was just so foreign, so different from what I was used to. There was a certain element of, what would you say? Naimono nedari. Do you know what that means?
Naimono nedari, no.
So it's kind of like the grass is always greener.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. I was like, oh, Japan, it just must be, you know, so much different and thus so much better in every way than what I'm used to. And
I think you're from Seattle, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Seattle's a wonderful place.
Yeah, it's a great city. Yeah.
What's Seattle famous for?
Coffee, Starbucks,
Fraser.
What's that?
Fraser.
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 What's that?
TV show.
Oh yeah, Fraser. Yeah,
Fraser. Did I say it wrong?
I don't know.
Fraser. Oh yeah, I haven't watched it.
Me neither.
I've seen a few episodes.
Me neither.
It's quite good, but so it sounds like you were interested in every kind of facet of Japanese pop culture.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you are so popular amongst YouTubers and folks living in Japan, because you are very much deeply invested in studying Japanese culture, the language, the way of life, in a way. And you've done it very successfully in a way that most of us haven't, including myself. Like, I know a lot about Japan, but I'm nowhere near your level when it comes to the language and the culture, I feel. So is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's fair because we just took kind of different trajectories in
perhaps,
terms of, like,
yes.
YouTube.
I mean, I came to Japan because I was more interested in trying to live in a different culture. I didn't know much about Japan before I came. I was more intrigued by what I would learn and how it would change me as a person, I think. Mm-hmm. And it gave an excuse to put my filmmaking hobby to the test. But, I mean, when you moved here, going back 10 years ago, you never thought, I'm going to be a YouTuber, I'm going to be producing videos, I'm going to be making sketches, right?
No, but I did think that I was going to become a writer.
Right.
So that was like my long time dream ever since, like, before graduating from university. Maybe, I don't know, some people might find this interesting, but one of the Japanese bands that got me into Japanese music, like, way back in the day, I ended up meeting them in person during my study abroad.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of, like, I had a couple conversations with the main singer, and that kind of inspired me to pursue a career related to some kind of art form.
Mm.
And I wrote a long letter before I met them. I didn't know if I would get to meet them or not, but they had, like, a MySpace at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so I typed up this really long letter in Japanese talking about how I was really grateful that, you know, that this band had existed, because it led to me being in Japan and study abroad, and I was having a really good time.
Mm.
And then I got a reply, and it's just like, come to our next show, we'd love to meet you. And I was like, what? But during, again, multiple conversations that I had with the main singer, she was like, yeah, that letter was, like, really, it really meant a lot to me. And so I thought, okay, maybe I could pursue, you know, a career in, like, writing or something like that.
What was your major? What did you do at university?
So it was Japanese linguistics. I started out with business.
Wow. Business.
But I really didn't like it at all. And
why was that? Because I studied business and linguistics, so I wasn't really into linguistics, but I was into the business side. So you and I
kind of, just
the opposite in that sense.
Yeah. It didn't match my personality. What would happen every day is I would go to, like, my accounting classes, and I would just, like, get, like, so frustrated and, like, depressed, and I would leave and go to my Japanese classes, and it would, like, you know, really brighten me up.
To be fair, I was the same. I think in my business degree, I almost failed the accounting bit.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't. There was no fun or creativity to be had, right?
Yeah, you kind of got to grind through that bit.
Yeah. And for me, business, it was a creative outlet, the entrepreneur aspects of it. But so you preferred linguistics.
Yeah. And so I originally, again, was going to major in business. But after that experience, I was like, I don't think I can really get passionate about this. So I switched to Japanese. And then after study abroad, I did kind of not quite a proper minor in creative writing as well. But I took, like, 3 or 4 classes on creative writing in addition to the Japanese studies as well during my last year of university.
And at university, what level of Japanese did that get you to? What kind of level of preparation?
M5
or?
It's hard to say, because I kind of concentrated on pronunciation and linguistics from the beginning.
Mm.
So I was always at a stage where the people around me in my Japanese classes could communicate in Japanese better than I could.
Right.
But I had a better Japanese accent than they did.
Why are you so interested in focusing on pronunciation and accent?
I'm not sure. I think one of the reasons is I hadn't seen too many – we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I hadn't seen too many foreigners speak with what
native sound.
Yeah. Right. What I thought sounded like native Japanese. Right. So I thought maybe I could be that person.
That's
then I would be like a special person.
A special person.
Yeah, then I could be someone in Japan.
In the pursuit of being a special person.
Exactly.
No, I completely get that. I do understand like why that would be quite thrilling and quite exciting to do. And you've succeeded to do that, right? Over a long-term period, your Japanese accent's very, very good, very much native.
Yeah, it's funny because I think a lot of people think that my Japanese pronunciation is better than it actually is. My knowledge of Japanese pronunciation is higher than my Japanese ability.
Right.
So kind of like arbitrary numbers, but like if my knowledge of Japanese pronunciation is like a 10 out of 10, then my actual skill is probably closer to like an 8.5 out of 10. If again, like a native speaker is a 10 out of 10.
Well, I mean, I remember I showed your video to Natsuki. Mm-hmm. And he was blown away. There's a video on Twitter where Natsuki says, "Oh, umai there, umai nihongo, dragon sugoi," because he got your name wrong and referred to you as Dragon, which I think, if you ever need to change your brand name, it should be Dragon in Japan.
Yeah, noted for Dragon, my next channel.
Dragon's Life. So you came here on the JET program after your study year abroad. Mm-hmm. And you were placed. Did you choose to be here in Kyushu in Beppu, the hot spring town?
Yeah. So I had a friend, a Japanese exchange student that studied abroad at the University of Washington,
right,
where I graduated
Seattle,
from.
Yeah.
And he was from Beppu. Mm. And so he said, if you can, what do you say, 希望できる, if you can write down where you want to go.
Have a, yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
Then you've already spent a year abroad in Tokyo. Mm, mm. It'd probably be good to see the other side, another side of Japan. Beppu is a cool city. Maybe try and go to Oita. So I wrote down Beppu. I ended up in a different part of Oita, about an hour train ride
so
from here.
Yeah. Beppu is considered to be Japan's biggest hot spring town, I think, with tons of hot springs. I mean, just walking around Beppu, you can see the sort of steam rising up through the vents. And it's an incredible city, one that I recommend you guys visit if you come to Japan. But they don't really let you choose where you get placed on the JET program, right?
Yeah.
Unless you have some sort of specific connection. Like I chose to be in Kobe, I ended up in Yamagata. You chose to be in Beppu and you kind of ended up nearby. So that worked.
Yeah.
But I guess there weren't that many ALTs who would have chosen Beppu.
Exactly.
Because there's not much knowledge about that part of Japan.
Yeah, everyone
then
wants to go to Kyushu or to
Tokyo or Kyoto, the standard ones, where there's actually no jobs going, so nobody ever gets there. But so you came here, you were here 3 years, and how was that kind of experience teaching? Because they say every assistant language teacher coming on the JET program, they say everybody has a different experience. Everybody has it different. How was yours?
Well, I was pretty stoic during the whole entire time. Or not stoic.
Stoic.
Spartan?
Spartan?
Basically, I just devoted my entire those 3 years to creative writing in Japanese.
God, you must have written a book.
Well, I wrote a couple of like short stories in Japanese at that time.
Wow.
I tried to, and then I got like a lot of feedback from native speakers. But
was it good feedback? The way you said that was like, it wasn't good feedback.
Well, initially,
I was writing, then they gave me feedback.
Yeah, initially it was very critical feedback.
Oh, God.
Which I needed.
Right.
Because I was under the very, what would you say, immature misunderstanding impression.
Right.
That just because I was pursuing a career in writing, I must inherently be good at writing. Like, I don't know anyone else who's trying to become a writer. Therefore,
right,
I must be a good writer. And so I showed some of what I had written to a friend that was a graduate from the Todai Bungaku, so Tokyo University Literature, College of Literature, I guess. And he kind of wrote like a really scathing but polite review. And it was really like, I can tell you're very, 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 very passionate about this, but these are the things that are...
What were some of the criticisms, out of curiosity?
The big one, and then the one that I've gotten over the years multiple times, is that you're trying too hard, because most of the... When I was studying creative writing in university, I was at the same time reading some of, like, you know, the greats, so to speak. So like Hemingway, Dostoevsky,
sure,
you know, like real literary geniuses.
Absolutely.
And so that's kind of what I was unconsciously striving for, which isn't good because I'm not a genius.
I think it's a common writer's dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, people aspire to be like those greats, but
time's
moved on. There's, good to have a contemporary angle as well. But do you still write today?
Well, I write, but only for my YouTube videos right now. But I actually, kind of going back to your previous point, one of the main feedback points that I got over and over again was that this thing that you wrote where you're really serious and you're trying to come across as, again, like this great, really cultured, writer, this feels really forced. But this other thing that you wrote that's like kind of got elements of comedy, this is pretty funny, actually.
Yeah.
And that was always kind of weird to me because comedy was the last thing that I ever thought I'd be able to do. Mm. I was never like the funny kid in school or anything like that. But my language professor or my creative writing professor in college told me, if you want to pursue writing, pursue comedy because that's what you're good at.
Interesting.
Among the things that you've written.
And clearly you are good at it because that's what your whole brand has sort of been built around. Your people throughout the world share your sort of sketches, critiques, your commentaries about Japanese culture, learning the language.
Yeah, it worked out in ways that I certainly hadn't anticipated.
So what are some of the most popular videos you've done? Or some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites. The ones that are really popular are probably the Japanese in 10 years video. And the whole premise of that video is that Japanese is slowly just becoming English with Japanese pronunciation.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
And actually, it's not in 10 years, it's already like that.
Yeah. Have you got some examples from that video?
Oh, yeah, sure.
On top of your head.
Like, if you say brainstorming, people like regularly say brainstorming in Japanese. Or like one that really, I don't know, this people will say like, who are you to say? It's, you don't have control over the Japanese language, but I much prefer the term zayakukan, which means guilty, than giruti, which is something that many Japanese people are starting to say.
There's a lot of expressions like that. It isn't good timing one as well. Good timing. I've heard.
Probably, yeah.
Like good timing.
Yeah.
I've heard like things like that. And
yeah.
Would that be technically gaidaigo, foreign borrowed word?
Yeah, so it's funny because if it is, Japanese pronunciation of a foreign word, then it is like what you just said. It is gaidaigo. It is actually Japanese.
Mm.
And oftentimes those words have slightly different meanings than their English or native counterparts, so to speak. So like naive is a good example.
Naive.
Yeah. In English, naive, one of the main meanings of it is you don't have a lot of knowledge of like a particular thing or you're kind of like sheltered, right?
Right.
You don't, know the world so much. But in Japanese, the nuance is more like you're a very emotional and sensitive person.
Ah.
So, like, I remember an ex-girlfriend once, and I am quite a sensitive person. That's just kind of my personality.
Mm.
And one of my ex-girlfriends, I was having a conversation with her, and she said, yeah, you really are quite naive. But she said it in Japanese.
Right.
So I thought she was saying you're really sheltered and you don't know a lot about the world. And we got in like this big fight over it.
Oh, gosh.
And then like after the fact, like when we were on like the verge of breaking up 2 weeks later, I was like, you weren't actually saying that thing to me. You were actually saying something that I agree with. I just didn't realize that the words have different meanings across languages.
It's interesting. I wonder at what point English words become accepted into Japanese language. Like, how does it begin? How does that process begin?
Well, I think this is kind of just my own perception of the phenomenon, but I think some people believe that using English makes them look more cultured.
Okay.
And so they kind of intentionally mix in English, English loan words in the place of Japanese words?
It's certainly quite prominent in products, right? In marketing.
English has an
air of prestige, except it doesn't because they often fuck it up.
Yeah.
The English comes off sounding really silly. But you think that's where it begins then?
Yeah, I think the point about advertising is very true. Like recently, I've seen ads that say like business person rather than, jinzai, kokusai jinzai, like, you know, international talent. So, yeah, I do think it's a way of, it's a method that people use to try and stand out, among other things.
It'd be interesting to see how that goes on as time progresses, more words become adopted. But going back to your time on JET, in between writing masterpieces and creative writing, how was your experience teaching? How old were the students?
I started out with just middle school, two middle schools.
So what, it's about 12 to 16?
Yeah.
Right.
And then during my last year, the Ministry of Education passed the policy to implement English into elementary schools as well.
Okay.
So during my last year, I started teaching at three elementary schools as well.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's a lot of skills.
Yeah. So to be frank, I never really enjoyed teaching English. I really liked interacting with the students and trying to, like, show things that, you know, were very foreign to them. Like, I had a couple of students that really, what would you say? They didn't know what to do with, like, their lives, so to speak, like their future. But they thought that the only thing that they could do was kind of pursue the traditional career paths that were around them. And so I remember trying to encourage, like, some students to, like, create their own business surrounding, like, a particular field. Like, I remember one student was, like, wanted to get into, like, translation or something.
Okay.
And but there was something about it that she didn't like. And I said, you know, you don't have to try and fit yourself into that, you know, peg or what do you say, into that.
Yeah.
You can make your own kind of translation business.
Oh, it's not as easy in Japan, though, is it? Starting a business is a very scary thing. Yeah. Failure is not accepted.
So I was trying to kind of bring over those, what would you say, more risky entrepreneurial elements of American culture.
Sure. I mean, that is one of the biggest differences between America and Japan, right?
Mm-hmm.
America is very good at fostering entrepreneurship and you can do anything. If you come from America, you believe, like, you can do anything. Whereas the UK is kind of in the middle, I think. Like, I can do anything. No, you can't. Get back in the office.
I can do almost anything.
Get back on the Excel spreadsheet. But no, I do find that that's a pretty sad aspect of Japanese culture.
That
people feel they don't have any social mobility. They don't feel they can do a lot. And when I was a teacher, you know, I was like, come on, you can do whatever you want. What do you want to be? And more often than not, it was, I want to work in an office. Mm-hmm. That was a very common answer, I think 70% of the time.
Yeah,
I
want to work
in an office. Like, I had worked in an office doing Excel spreadsheet stuff, and it was not very fulfilling. So I was always trying to push them. But
yeah, exactly. Same kind of thing, you know, like there are other options. Like you can give it a try, so to speak.
Absolutely. But, I mean, and so because you had so many schools, was it difficult to build up a relationship with the students and
it really
you're sort
depended
of being shuffling
on,
between classes.
Yeah, it depended on the student. The schools were actually each quite small.
Mm.
So despite going to multiple schools, I knew all my students by name.
Oh, that's cool.
And like the ones that were particularly interested in English, I was obviously much closer to.
Yeah.
But it was not as difficult as you might imagine.
Right. Well, that's reassuring to hear. Because, everyone has a different experience. I was very lucky. I had like this biggest senior high school in North Japan. So I had just one school for the 3 years.
And then
whilst I had a lot of students, I was still able to build up a lot of relationships. So, how do you look back on your time as an English teacher overall? Favorably or ambivalent?
Well, I'm glad that maybe I was potentially able to help or I don't want to say inspire because that makes me sound like
inspire.
More important than I actually am. But hopefully I was able to help the students that were interested in learning English.
Mm.
And I certainly know that the JET program offered me a lot of opportunities for kind of my future in Japan, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Like it gave me an opportunity to work in a Japanese environment.
Yep.
Learned a lot of Japanese. Learned a lot about areas of Japan that aren't Tokyo.
Sure. And you don't regret going on it at all?
No, not at all.
That's reassuring.
Yeah.
I must admit, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's really, truly regretted going on the JET program. And that's pretty reassuring. And whilst I share your I'm completely in the same boat as you. I don't know how easily I can quantify the impact that I had. But hopefully there were a few students who I was able to help, and that's the only thing you can take away from it, really.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't want to be an English teacher again.
No.
But, again, that's not to say that I regretted the time at all.
No.
I learned a lot during that time.
And you, like me, we've both done 3 years, right? I think any more than that, and I would have gone insane. But that was the right amount to enjoy it, to learn from it, and to get out of it. But
One thing that we talked briefly about during a Q&A that we did a couple of years ago on my channel is that one of the things about the JET program is that depending on what you studied in university, oftentimes you don't actually use what you studied in the JET program, and you kind of, depending on your situation, you can end up kind of as just like a tape recorder.
Yeah.
And it can be very stressful to be in that situation and watch your friends back home kind of climb up their career path. Like, I had friends going to like Google and Deloitte and Accenture, and I was like, here I am, not making any progress.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? Mine's pretty low after coming back from the craziness of WrestleMania, too many body slams and all that. And I'm pretty jealous of my co-host Chris, who seems to have been exploring Japan's most isolated hotel. He's definitely winning in the relaxation race, but I'm determined to catch up with him. It can be easy to get swept up in social gatherings and spread ourselves too thin, but with therapy, you can learn to prioritize your time and recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Japan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Japan.
Join us on the Football Ramble as we explore the ridiculous world of football. We bring in-depth analysis of the biggest moments, like Bruno Fernandes' one-eyed penalties.
Sounds like a Metallica song.
Yeah, it does.
But obviously, like, one eye open.
But if you have one eye closed, you know your perception. So imagine if you tried the dink and it just like went like 2 feet in front of him.
Yeah. Every weekday we cover the good, the bad and the Newcastle.
Although Shelby wasn't surprised either. He said the way they play isn't great.
And you couldn't fucking beat him, could you?
Could Shelby be the mole?
Didn't Bruce accuse the mole of treason?
To the Geordie Nation.
Yeah.
Putting the football world to rights.
If you want to put a message on a T-shirt under your shirt, slag it off your mind.
Yeah.
That is an absolute minefield in the dressing room.
Don't worry, lads, I'll put it in another language. Do you know how many languages that man speaks?
Not with Roy. I won't wash with Roy.
We're here with the biggest stories from the sport we love, and we want you to get involved too. Search the Football Ramble on your favourite podcast player to listen now.
This was a Stakhanov production.
I definitely had days when I was standing in front of 40 students going, I like penguins, repeat after me, like penguins. And I thought, what the fuck have I done? Why am I doing this? I studied for 3 years, I spent billions on my degree, and I'm standing in a room being a tape recorder. But that was my first year. After that, I really pushed back. And the teachers, I had 10 teachers I worked with, and over half of them were like, Christensen, you do what you want. You kind of go along with it. And so those were the classes where I was able to get students to write a short film or do skits or act things out. And those were where I was able to kind of have impact and enjoy it. And, you know, the coolest thing I did was get the students to make a magazine and things like that.
So, yeah,
it was fun. But no, definitely there were a lot of classes that are like that. And inevitably, if you come and teach in Japan, whether it's JET, whether it's NOVA, whether it's any teaching program, you will find yourself doing that and having that, have I chosen the right path here moment?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that I always encourage people that are doing English teaching to develop another skill set on the side unless you actually love English and would just and be just as happy teaching English outside of Japan.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was lucky during my time teaching. I learned Japanese in my free time. I was able to build the YouTube channel. So I got a lot of it in that regard. But, what an experience it was.
Yeah, it's pretty cliche to, like, quote Steve Jobs at this point. But one of the things that he said at his, like, Stanford speech is, you don't know how the dots are going to align. And, again, going back to what we just said, there's moments there when you're like, God, I'm never going to be able to get, like, a proper job back in the States. And I'm not really making any more money staying on the JET program.
But, I mean, if you go back to, you said that, you know, you had those moments where your friends were going off to big blue chip companies, successful careers.
Yeah.
At the same time, teaching aside, living in Japan, the experience of living in Japan, living in the rural countryside and learning a language, that was way more exciting than any job you could have at Google or Accenture or wherever. You're getting so much out of it. And for me, the overall experience of living in Japan and teaching was an incredible one, and that outweighed working in a big company with lots of money, I think.
Yeah.
Can't get that. And, I had friends that did go into those sort of companies and regretted it later on down the line because they make good money, but your chance to live and work in Japan is sort of diminished and you can't ever do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's ups and downs, really.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because, again, I was looking back and being like, oh, I've made a mistake. I'll never be able to get to that point. And now I'm on the opposite side of the spectrum where I'm looking at those friends who are still in those companies, and many of them, like you said, they've come to not like their jobs too much anymore. And we've been both lucky enough to have successful content creation, you know, jobs.
Absolutely. And I feel very lucky to be in that position. So, something to bear in mind to those of you choosing your careers. I was actually looking at getting a job at Accenture, which is a consulting firm, and I looked at it. And I'm very glad I didn't. I'm very glad I pursued. A lot of people thought I was mad to come and teach English. I remember, because I did all right at university. I've never been very good academically, but I had a good run at university, and I was expected to get a good consulting job, make lots of money and live a life of, that would be it. But I've never regretted that once. And that's something to really think about. There's more to life than a big salary from a blue chip company.
For sure.
So after you finished JET, you carried on teaching, but in a university capacity.
Actually, no. What I did is I kind of did visa hopping between Japan and Korea for almost a year.
Oh, God.
So, like, my JET visa ran out. Well, it ran out because I said I'm going to stop after 3 years. And so that was my decision. But because of that, I had to leave Japan that August that year. And so what I did is I didn't want to just go back to the States. So I said, okay, I'm going to go to Korea for 6 months and live in, like, this little kind of hostel place.
Oh, wow.
And so I did that, and I pursued creative writing the entire time. So it was just basically I was living off my savings from the JET program. I saved all my money when I was on the JET program.
You did the opposite to me.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Because all I did was creative writing. So I just sat in my cheap apartment and write all the time. And so I was able to save close to, like, I don't know, $30,000-ish dollars across 3 years.
Nice one.
Yeah. And so I lived off of that. And I was lucky enough to have not have had to bear college tuition. My parents paid for my college tuition.
You lucky rascal.
Yes. I was very, very, very lucky. And so because of that, I was able to live off of my savings for about a year before I started to have to really get in a position where I was like, okay, I got to start working again. This is getting...
Well, it sounds like you kind of were working by writing.
Well, yes. I was developing my skills.
But then you came back here.
Yes.
And found another job, presumably.
Yeah. And so what actually happened is that guy that I mentioned earlier, who was from Beppu, he connected me to the cram school teacher that for the cram school that he used to go to in Beppu, and I ended up working there for about a year.
So you found your way back into the world of teaching English, basically.
Yes.
How was that in comparison to JET?
Well, it was very, very different because on JET I had a lot more kind of flexibility, and whereas like the cram school is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's meant to kind of cram knowledge into the students such that they're able to pass university exams.
Presumably you would have worked in evenings because students finish school,
correct.
Then they go to a cram school for 2 hours to learn some stuff to pass a bloody exam.
Correct. And so when I was teaching on the JET program, I had a little bit of flexibility too, and I was trying to kind of teach the students more relaxed conversation. So I was teaching them things like, I want to go, I got to go, instead of like, I must go, have to go. So I was trying to teach them kind of realistic conversational English, so to speak. But when I tried to do that in the juku, the teacher kind of sat me down and said, this isn't working. And to be fair, I didn't have, what would you say, like a proper like syllabus.
Sure.
I was kind of winging it to a certain extent.
Well, I used to do what you did there. When I was a teacher, I would be like, I want to. I'm going to the shop. Talks like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, again, the cram school, the metric for success is, are they going to pass the test?
Exactly.
And in the test, they don't have, I want to go, I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. It's very much a silly kind of written test.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
I mean, and in terms of how English is taught in Japan, what do you think? Is it done well?
I don't think it's done well. I think that it's it seems like it's changing for the better right now.
I got that impression. Mm-hmm. Well, just in my last year, they started focusing a lot more on conversation.
Yeah.
Which is good because I think it's very much textbook heavy. It's very much written and writing. Mm-hmm. And the best part of the funnest part of learning Japanese for me has been using it in conversation in everyday life, talking to friends like Natsuki or Ryotaro. And so I feel like they need to focus more on that because students will understand why English is fun.
Yeah.
And a lot of the students don't understand why they're learning English as well.
Yeah.
I tried to teach them, like, if you learn English, you can live in every country in the world because it's the global language and you've got a lot more business opportunities, a lot more work opportunities. Mm-hmm. I always pushed that because I got the impression the students, certainly in the rural area that I live, they were like, why do we need it?
I'm just going to work
on a farm or an office.
Like, exactly.
You know. And a lot of my Japanese friends in their 40s regret not being better at English later on in life. But so after the cram school, what happened then?
Okay, yeah. So actually when I was working at the cram school, the teacher there that hired me, she knew that I was trying to pursue writing.
Mm.
And she very, very graciously kind of hired me with a minimal work schedule such that I could teach just enough in order to get enough money to like pay my rent.
Mm.
And then if I was frugal, I could live off of that and also practice writing or, you know, just try and write many hours each day. And that's what I did.
Oh, wow.
And then during that time, I met my now wife.
Yeah.
And it became obvious to me that if we were going to have a future together, that I would need a proper job. And so I applied to Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University, and I got a job there doing student recruitment. And that was like my first, like, what would you say, proper job.
You're saying the JET program isn't a proper job?
Well, it wasn't as, what would you say, demanding as like what I did at APU.
And throughout this time, what level are we talking for your Japanese? Like when you're on the JET program, how good was your Japanese?
You know, it's very funny because, like I said earlier, I can't remember if I said this during the podcast or during the live stream, but
because we did a live stream just before this podcast.
I think we said it in the podcast, yes. But my Japanese, because I concentrated on pronunciation for a long time,
right?
It was my pronunciation was always pretty decent compared to my peers.
Yeah.
But I had to play catch up big time after graduating from university.
Right.
And so during kind of like those years concentrating on the creative writing, I was doing that in Japanese. And so it was a little bit odd because I never got like really good at kanji or really good at like advanced grammar or anything like that. But I did get to a point where I became confident in doing a very specific type of creative writing in Japanese.
Mm.
And so my conversational Japanese was certainly, you know, better than average. But, I mean, there's many, many people who speak conversational Japanese better than me.
Have you done the JLPT tests?
Yeah.
What point did you pass JLPT N1, for example?
So I did, like, a practice test to assess my Japanese during, I think, my first year of the JET program.
Yeah.
And I scored into the N1.
Wow.
But then when I started studying for it, I was like, wait, this is like way too hard for me. So I actually took like a hiatus from my creative writing for like almost a year. And I studied for the JLPT. But it was funny because I studied in a way that was similar to the way that I'd studied for tests in the American education system.
Right.
And what I mean by that is that it's basically just testing your knowledge, whereas the JLPT, in my opinion, to a certain extent, it's testing your knowledge and your ability to take the JLPT.
Yeah, it's a funny old exam. I mean, I've taken N2. Mm-hmm. I took it once on my only 2 years in studying Japanese. I did it as a test run, but I was able to get I got like 49% or something.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty good for 2 years of studying Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
And I regret not carrying on studying and passing N1, something I'll have to do eventually, inevitably. Mm-hmm. But, it seems like a lot of the textbooks that teach you how to pass the JLPT exam,
it's about
passing the exam rather than the knowledge itself.
Exactly.
Which feels inherently wrong.
Yes.
And is how you get tested in Japan for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very silly. And there's no conversation aspect at all, is there?
Correct, yeah.
Which is massively flawed because a lot of people I know who are very good with their memories, who can't speak Japanese that well, would sail through the exams.
Yeah. So I was kind of the opposite where my strength, my pronunciation, wasn't getting tested. And so
the one thing you're super duper...
Well, knowledgeable about,
yes.
Yeah. So I took the test, but I actually had like a panic attack during the test because...
Oh, God.
Sorry, technical difficulties. Okay, I think we're back. Again,
panic attack.
I only studied the knowledge.
Right.
And so what happened during the test is... I was like, okay, this is the real test. I got to take my time and make sure that I'm like not, you know, marking my bubbles wrong or anything like that.
Sure.
And so I was like, okay, C. Okay, this is C on my answer sheet. Okay, I'm going to double check that. Okay, I'm going to triple check that. And so what happened was what you should do if you want to pass the JLPT is you should just take a bunch of timed practice tests such that you know how long you have and stuff like that for each section, rather than trying to memorize all the information. So I got through like the grammar section of the test, like up until the reading section, and I looked up and I had way less time than I thought that I had. Because I was so stupid, I didn't ever do a proper timed practice test.
Oh, God.
Again, I just did like... The knowledge. I just studied the knowledge. And so, like, half of the reading section, I just did, like, all C.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I happened to get a grade that was, you know, good enough to pass. But it was funny because the my score for the grammar section, I got a perfect score on that section.
Oh, wow.
Because that's what I had studied, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then when I got to the other bit, I absolutely, you know, bombed that bit. And so I've never felt good about that. And so recently I've actually been studying to take the test again.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah.
You don't need to, though, surely.
Well, actually, I do.
Why?
Because most of my knowledge, again, it's related to pronunciation.
So you've lost some of the words.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
A fair amount, actually.
On the subject of learning Japanese, what tips do you have for new learners? Because inevitably a lot of you guys listening are learning Japanese at an early level. But what any tips and advice?
Yeah, I think my number one piece of advice would be to kind of, what would you say, use a study method similar to what my friend Matt versus Japan recommends.
Right.
And that's fully immersion-based approach.
Okay.
Like, just listen to Japanese all the time.
Yeah.
And one thing that I like to really recommend is watch the same Japanese movie, like, over and over and over and over and over again until you've literally memorized every single line in the movie.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
Certainly when I was in my first and second year studying hardcore immersion, when I, you know, after a long day at work where I'd be exposed to Japanese listening and I'd use it, I'd have like a TV on, I'd watch a sitcom or something, and then I'd pick up the words in that as well. So it's a really good idea. Full immersion.
Yeah.
Full immersion.
Yeah.
Try and watch things, try and listen to things in between studying. So
yeah,
it comes up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's nothing more rewarding than learning some new words or some grammar and then hearing it.
Yes.
Or, you know,
yeah,
out
for sure.
And about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So on the subject of YouTube, let's talk about YouTube.
Okay.
How you became a YouTuber.
through my collaborations with abroad in Japan.
Definitely. Like, so you started your YouTube channel while you were...
At APU.
Working at the university. And how did that come about, starting YouTube?
Well, I started to get, what would you say, itchy at APU.
Itchy.
Because up until then, I had really... always had that creative outlet on the side where I was pursuing creative writing. But once I started working at APU, initially I was too busy with my day job.
And your job was getting
it was student recruitment,
encouraging students to come to Asia Pacific University.
Yeah, so I would go all across Japan and also like Southeast Asia.
Wow.
And be like, hey, come to this university.
It's pretty cool.
You know, pretty cool. Yeah, the travel element was really, really cool.
But there's no real creative outlet.
Exactly.
Right.
And so after about a year of that, after I got a little bit used to the job and it wasn't so stressful, I was like, I wasn't happy with the work.
Mm.
Again, it was fun traveling, but I didn't like the work at all. And so I was like, okay, I got to do something to kind of scratch that creative itch. And so I thought... well, maybe what I'll try and do is I've got all these, you know, scripts and essays and even short novels that I've written from like my time in the JET program and before. These never did particularly well in just the written format. But what if I took these and delivered them as like little, what would you say, bits? Skits?
Skits, yeah.
Yeah, on YouTube.
And your videos, how long are they on average? 4 to 5 minutes?
I think on average, maybe between 1 and 2 minutes, although I've done some pieces that are like closer to like 30 minutes.
Mm.
So it really depends on the video, but most of them are relatively short, yeah.
Was it quite a big deal making your first video for YouTube?
Yes and no. And what I mean by that is I had kind of a strategy from the beginning where the initial few videos were rather broad in terms of the audience. And then I gradually narrowed down the strike zone.
Mm.
So my first video, you may remember, I don't know if I showed you or not, but it was actually like this like fake phone review that had nothing to do with Japan.
You did show me, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, but that was a comedy video.
Mm.
But at the time, like tech reviewers on YouTube were really, really popular. And I thought it would be funny to do like kind of like a parody version of these. And so that's what I did for my first video. And it didn't do... particularly well, but it was my first video, so it wouldn't do well. I had no audience. It did okay because I had like, I don't know, 500 subscribers at that point already from when I was tricking before. In university, I used to do this sport called tricking. It's kind of like martial arts mixed with gymnastics.
It's very cool. I wish I could do it.
Everyone
can do a backflip out of thin air.
I used to be able to.
Throw themselves back and do a backflip.
I used to be able to.
Whereas... I can only fall down the stairs. That's my magic trick. But like, it's pretty cool, tricking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But everyone that did tricking, well, most people that did tricking were self-taught, and they learned by watching videos of other people and analyzing videos of themselves. Mm. So when YouTube came around, everyone that did tricking immediately signed up.
Right.
Because it was like, finally, we don't have to like pool our money together to like host videos you know, these obscure sites. So I got on YouTube actually in like 2006.
But when was it that your YouTube career took off again in Japan?
Yeah, so again,
2015, 14?
2016, January 1st is when I uploaded that
phone
review.
The date, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I knew that I had set a deadline for myself is why I remember it. So that first video was like, again, this fake phone review that 500 people saw because they were subscribers from back in the day. Mm. And I had I want to say maybe like 200 or 300 fans that were following me because of my writing.
Yeah.
Because I had published some stuff online on like my own website and other places. But
one thing, when I talk to a lot of friends who I know who do YouTube, one of the things they have in common is none of them really expected any success. They did YouTube because they just enjoyed it fundamentally, the creative process. Like I never, for the first 2 years that I did this, I don't think I even knew you could make money from YouTube until 2 years in. But like, did you have any expectations from it? Do you think my goal is 100,000 subscribers, I'm going to get this? Or was it just, I just enjoy doing this and we'll see what happens? Like, was there any strategy? Was it any expectations, success?
Yeah, I don't know. This probably is kind of the opposite of what a lot of people say, and this will make me sound like an ass, but I went in with the mindset, I'm going to make this work, and I'm going to become successful at this.
Right.
And so I uploaded a video, no matter what, every single Monday, every week for, I think, 2 years, at least until my kids were born.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was during that time that my channel really had the what would you say, the
exploded,
big growth period that it did.
Consistency is one of the most important aspects of success on YouTube, right?
Yeah, you know. And again, the thing that might rub people the wrong way is I did have confidence in my writing ability. I felt I'm good enough to at least get to a point where I can do this and get by for a living.
And how long were you doing YouTube while you were working before you were able to become a full-time YouTuber? Because you did it in a relatively short space of time compared to someone like, I think myself, it took me 3 to 4 years, maybe?
Yeah.
Before I was fully invested in YouTube and I was doing YouTube full-time.
Well, let's see. I guess it was closer to two years. Although, to be fair, when my kids were born, I want to say my kids were born about 2 years after I started properly, you know, trying to do YouTube. And then I went on parental leave from APU for a year and a half. So I was still technically an employee there.
Paternity leave.
Yes, exactly.
Genius.
Exactly.
Oh, that's the best time to start a YouTube channel and grow it.
Yeah. I didn't actually end up with more time because I was now raising two kids. I have twin daughters. But I was able to still upload, not as consistently as before, but I was able to upload and I tried to also maintain what I thought was the level of quality that I had kind of established up until that point. And after I had a 5-year contract with APU, so I was on the parental leave for a year and a half. Mm. And when that was over, my Patreon was doing well enough that I just went on to Patreon.
Yeah, and this is something that's really interesting that might be relevant to smaller creators or folks who have a kind of a niche target audience. You built your kind of YouTube business around Patreon to some extent. Because you're so good with pitch, accent, and Japanese, you created a course that you sold through Patreon, and then that became almost a bigger part of business than your YouTube channel, right?
Oh, yes, much bigger for me, yeah.
Which is fantastic, I think, because it can be difficult as a YouTube creator. You've got to find your niche, and often your niche isn't big enough to create the ad revenue to build a business.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting strategy. And I often talk to people in different sectors who have a kind of a niche market.
Yeah,
like, it was the Doga model, as I call it.
Well, what had happened was, I think I was like, I don't know, 6 or 7 months into YouTube.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I must, you know, be close to making some decent money by now. And then, like, it was around that time that also my channel got, like, monetized.
Yeah.
And then I got, like, my first paycheck from YouTube, and it was, like, $2 for, like, a month or something. And I was
$2.
Like, this is not going to work. And so, actually, what happened is around that same time, one of my videos, someone from like the Learn Japanese Reddit,
yeah,
there's a Reddit about learning Japanese, they posted my video there and it got a bunch of upvotes, and I saw like 1,000 new subs like overnight, and I was like, where did this come from on Twitter? And someone said, oh, they posted it on Learn Japanese. So I went over there and I said, I'm the creator of this video, ask me anything. And then a bunch of people said, your stuff is really fun and interesting, you should make a Patreon, I would love to support it. And so I was like, Patreon, what's that? And so, you know, I kind of did a little bit of research, and I ended up going with a strategy that, I don't know, I've never really liked just, you know, I'm here, I'm doing this thing, give me money, you know.
Sure.
So I thought I should try and offer some kind of product to Absolutely. Incentivize people giving me their donation. And so I was like, okay, well, I've got like all this knowledge of pitch accent, and this typically isn't taught. So maybe I'll make like a few lessons about this, and that ended up turning into like this big series. And
in many ways, the YouTube channel promotes the Patreon.
Exactly,
and the
exactly.
Patreon's become the business, this pitch accent course that you teach.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So my passion lies in the comedic stuff, the creative writing, but at the end of all my videos is Japanese pronunciation lessons on Patreon. So my comedic content serves as an advertisement for the phonetics course.
It's really interesting. I mean, I have a Patreon for Abroad in Japan, and I completely share your sentiments. I've always tried to put a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff on there, like behind-the-scenes vlogs and articles, and with Journey Across Japan.
Yeah.
I've got some upcoming behind-the-scenes episodes coming out. And when I started Patreon, which was around the same time you did, I felt a bit guilty, you know, this idea of asking people to sort of invest or believe in the channel like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a big leap, but I'm glad it's become more of a mainstream thing now, and everyone's on Patreon these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's great for all creators.
And you can set up a Patreon for so many things, and it's just opened the doors for
the creative sector as a whole. People are creative.
Like, yeah. There's demand for these products and services that it was just invisible up until this point.
Right, yeah.
To a certain degree.
And it's good that we don't have to live and die by YouTube's scary ad revenue system, which frequently bloody demonetizes
things. Yeah, just now, like 4-5 years into it, I guess at this point, 5.5 years into it at this point, I'm finally at a point where I'm making as much money on YouTube as I was at APU.
Wow, really?
Yeah, finally, five and a half years into it.
To wrap things up, though, to our listeners who are considering living and working in Japan, any key tips you'd like to
impart? Maybe a couple of things. I'll try and keep this concise, though. I love living in Japan. I really, really like living here. I think I have a very lucky and blessed life. But I do think that besides that, Japan is, generally speaking, again, this is just coming from my own experiences, but is a nice, pleasant place to live. The food is amazing. People are, generally speaking, very nice.
Yeah.
And it's very, very safe. And it's also quite modern in terms of, like, technology and not usefulness, but guys, convenience. So I do think that Japan is a wonderful place to live. And I hope that more people come to live in Japan, because it saddens me that the population of Japan is going down
very quickly as well.
Very quickly, and that it's really starting to have a negative impact on the country in terms of like economics and like the social security system. And
it's becoming in the countryside where friends like Natsuki live.
He's seen
his business affected just because the population has dropped.
Exactly.
Tens of thousands of people.
So it's in my own selfish interest to hope that as many people come to Japan and have, you know, happy lives here. But just, again, I've always been fascinated by Japanese culture, and I love Japan, and I want Japan to continue to be a great place to live for as many people as possible, including Japanese people and including foreigners. So I do think that If you're interested in coming to Japan, do come to Japan. It's awesome, especially if you've been one of those people like me that wanted to go to Japan their whole lives. You'll love it.
I don't know many people that have come to Japan and had a bad experience. And I'd say if you're thinking about it, do come to Japan. Even if you come for 1 year and it's not what you think it is, you can always go back. But you'll have the experiences along the way that you'll hopefully treasure for your lifetime.
Yeah.
So either way, you win if you come to Japan, I think.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was going to say is that English can be a great way to get your foot in the door. But I think the key to a successful life in Japan and for the long term is knowing what you really want to do for work.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you do get your foot in the door through English, develop a skill set again on the side and make sure that that's something that you actually like to do.
And from the get-go, when you come and start teaching, start thinking about the next thing.
So yeah, have a roadmap.
Yeah, and you've got a three-year head start if you are teaching for 3 years. Mm-hmm. But so thank you so much for coming on the show, Dogan, and sharing your story.
Yeah, it was
awesome. Check out Dogan on YouTube, on Twitter, D-O-G-E-N. D-O-G-E-N. Dogan. But thank you very much. And we'll be back on the podcast on Sunday, guys, do it all over again. But for now, no matter where you might be, out there in the big wide world, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll see you on Sunday. Have a good one.
See you guys.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.